Support for this podcast comes from Avangrid.
This is definitely a blue-collar community, and I'm kind of a blue-collar guy.
Rick Sealscott didn't see himself as a farmer, but wasn't about to sell his grandparents' Ohio farm. An Avangrid wind farm pays millions to the community and landowners like him each year.
Farming's up and down, but the wind turbines give us steady income. We're holding on to the farm, and we're making money. And I would absolutely do it again.
Discover where energy meets humanity at avangrid.com.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, if you're found to be guilty of murder and sane, you could spend 25 years in prison. But if you're found to be not guilty by reason of insanity, you could be confined to an institution for 587 years, when not guilty is actually a life sentence. It's Friday, September 29th. Mac, tell me about the first time that you went to visit Houston at Napa State Hospital.
There's like a prison fence, like a tall fence, and there's barbed wire, and you have to be let through a series of doors. It's like you have to pass the one and then be in a corridor where that one is closed before the next one will open.
Mm-hmm. Mac McClelland has been reporting on the small percentage of people who make their way through the criminal justice system and end up in psychiatric hospitals.
And then, you know, behind this other heavy, like, locked door, we're led into this room. No colors. All of the patients are dressed in beige. Everything is beige. Everything feels beige.
So what is Houston like?
He's pretty funny. He's charming, if you like dark humor, which I do. But, you know, he's young and he looks young. He's got kind of a baby face and real wide blue eyes. And he is obsessed with philosophy. If he was going to go to college, he was super into the idea of studying philosophy. And so he's always reading philosophy. He has people send him, like people in his family and friends, send him these like enormous philosophical treatises and books. So he's very smart.
How did you become interested in this story of Houston and his case?
Well, I found out about what happened between Houston and his father from my mom. She called and said that one of my cousins had killed his dad.
Wait, so Houston is your cousin?
Yeah, he's my third cousin.
Wow.
For us, like, it was distressing, of course, and for his more immediate family. Like, my cousin, Savannah, Houston's sister, that's her dad, obviously.
Right.
That's her father and her brother. And she was only 17. And so I can't even begin to imagine, honestly, what she could possibly have been going through, especially since she was there.
Savannah, can you tell me about your family?
Our family was the typical family. My brother is 4 years older than me, so I was really annoying to him as a child.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't start to get close until high school because he was a senior in high school when I was a freshman, so he had to drive me to school. And at that point, we started to get much closer.
I want to ask you about your dad. Tell me a little bit about him.
My dad was probably the greatest person I knew. Most kids grow up watching Disney movies, and I grew up watching South Park and every horror movie. My whole family has a pretty dark sense of humor as well. He was also a really good musician, so a lot of our childhood was him playing guitar and going to his gigs. And then that rubbed off on Houston, and then he learned to play guitar. And sometimes they would play together. But you could tell that Houston didn't play many solos in his life to understand when to stop the solo. So Houston was just in the zone going on and on. When the song finally ends, you can see my dad go over and like put his arm around my brother. You can tell he was really proud.
Thank you. Thank you.
Everything was really good until Houston graduated high school, and that's when he started to go downhill. We knew something was wrong, but we didn't know what was wrong. We thought he was just really depressed. We didn't know. It was just weird things. Like, I remember one specific night, something happened. He got mad for some reason, and he went outside, and he smashed the headlight of his car. He just got in his front seat and started crying, which was really odd because he never cried, and I've never seen him cry. And I tried to go talk to him, but he just told me to leave him alone. Just weird things.
He was becoming increasingly paranoid and withdrawn and extremely agitated. And everybody around him could see that, but they didn't really know what to do about it.
I'm just going to start from the beginning, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay. So I went to the movies with some friends, and I believe school just got out for Thanksgiving vacation, so we had the week off. And I went home, and it was about, like, 10:30. For some reason, I decided to go to bed early. And I went out, and I talked to my dad, who was sitting on the chair watching TV. And then I went to bed, and then around 1 in the morning, I heard this screaming that was, like, really high-pitched, not anything I've ever heard before. So I was going to go out and ask my dad what was going on, but once I got into the living room, I could see in the hallway opening up to the kitchen that my dad was on the ground. Sorry.
It's okay.
She had to run past them to get the phone.
Wow.
And she picked up the phone and ran with it to her room, and Houston followed her, and he was still holding a knife. And she shut the door to her bedroom on him, and he just stopped.
In that very moment, I don't think you really have the ability to feel fear. I think I was just in total shock.
Mm-hmm.
So I honestly don't even remember if I locked my door to my room.
Houston stabbed his father more than 50 times.
Wow.
In the autopsy, they said that, you know, based on the wounds, Houston had been trying to decapitate him.
Physically, it was my brother. But mentally, it's hard to wrap your mind around that your brother could do something like that.
So he pled not guilty by reason of insanity at his trial. And it was up to the jury, actually, not to doctors and not to the judge, but it was up to a jury to decide whether he was not guilty by reason of insanity or not. And that verdict is actually extremely difficult to get in a jury trial.
I actually testified, and I testified last. I did testify on his behalf.
On his behalf?
Yes.
Against all odds, I mean, literally against, like, all statistical odds, he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. Because of that, he was sent to hospital instead of to prison. If it was, like, a movie and it was a courtroom scene, like, the people on Houston's side, they would have, like, thrown their hands up and started crying happily. His immediate family, they were glad he was going to the hospital. That's what they wanted, was treatment.
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought of being found not guilty by reason of insanity as a kind of get-out-of-jail-free card. Is that right? Does the verdict here mean that Houston gets off with a lighter punishment than if he'd been found to be sane?
Well, that's sort of the million-dollar question. Everybody in our family and in his family thought that, like, otherwise he would have gone to prison for 25 to life. So this is better than that, and this will be less than that. He can still have a life. Again, mm-hmm. He was in his early 20s. he'll go to a hospital, he'll get treated, and then he'll move on. And it wasn't until after he was in the hospital that everyone realized that it does not necessarily work that way.
How do you mean?
In every state, you can automatically commit a person involuntarily to a hospital after they've been found not guilty by reason of insanity. In every state, you can do that. And in almost every state, there's no limit to how long you can confine them. The maximum release date on Houston's paperwork is December 31st, 2600.
2600.
It's 587 years after he was committed. This is where I started getting involved in this story more as a journalist, and it became more than just a family matter. And the more that I was looking, the more I realized that nobody is really in charge of keeping track of, first of all, the number of people in this population. Second of all, how long they've been in the hospital for, like how long we're keeping them against their will, or particularly what is happening to them while they're there. You don't want to be the judge who let the psychiatric patient out of the hospital and then that person hurts somebody. Like, you don't want to be that judge. You don't want to be the prosecutor who didn't object to that person getting out. And the public, by and large, it's not like the public is clamoring for the rights of forensic patients. There's so much stigma and so much misunderstanding in our culture about what that means, about what mental illness is. Nobody is saying like, hey, are we treating these people right? Are we keeping them for too long? Should we be letting them out? Are we upholding their constitutional rights? The answer is no. And there are all kinds of due process violations going on, and everybody knows that.
They're essentially a forgotten segment of the American criminal justice system, it sounds like.
They don't belong to the criminal justice system quite, and they don't belong to the mental health care system quite. And they also belong to both. Somehow that makes less transparency, less accountability for what is happening to them.
Right.
And because these people are sort of the wards of the court and the hospital, right? Even if all the doctors, and this has happened, this does happen, if all the doctors, all Houston's doctors in this case, came before the court and they said, he is not dangerous, or if they said, he's not mentally ill, or he's not mentally ill or dangerous, in our opinion, the decision is most often actually left up to a judge. And so the judge could still decide that this person is dangerous because of their mental illness, and they could keep him.
So, Savannah, do you think that your brother is still dangerous?
No. I don't.
And why not?
I think that now he's on his medication, he's been back to himself. Part of me still fears it a little bit, but it's only like when I think back on that night, like, I think he would be fine. I thought a lot, like, I would be kind of nervous for him to live with my mom, but he loves my mom. Like, every time they're there, he holds her hand the whole time. So I think it would be fine. I think it's just the fear of the unknown more so than like the fear of him. I mean, I really just have to separate it. Like, when I go to visit him, I know that he did it, but I can't think of it. Him as that person in that moment. It all seems kind of dreamlike now. Like, I'll talk about it and I'm like, did that really happen to me?
It did.
It did, yeah.
You know, Savannah would be the first to tell you, she has complicated feelings about this.
He could have easily killed me if he wanted to, and actually that bothered me, like, this year I was thinking about it, and I called my brother and I asked him, why didn't you kill me either, and he said he didn't know. Wow. That if he thought about it, he would have.
If he'd thought about it, he would have. Are you in the process of forgiving your brother now?
I forgive him in some ways, but in a sense, I don't think I'll ever be able to forgive him completely. I can't really explain it. Like, I still go to visit him, but I was just talking to my mom about this the other day, and she's been having a hard time with him, and it just seems like she said that it seems like he should be apologizing to us every time he sees us, and he doesn't. Like, I only got one apology one time in a letter. So I don't know if he can ever forgive himself enough for me to forgive him.
Hello?
Hey, is this Houston?
Yeah.
Houston, it's Michael Barbaro from the New York Times.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm okay, yeah.
Where are you? Where am I reaching you?
Well, I'm on a ward here at Napa State Hospital at a payphone in a very populated hallway. Some patients sort of shambling through. There's usually an ambience of people saying random things, if that makes sense. And there's also an observation room 5 feet away from me with a florally psychotic woman in it. I mean, one second.
It's okay.
They're announcing something, so it's very loud and difficult to hear.
What's the announcement?
The announcement is just for people to get their meds. Not me. I'm not included. People have received medications all throughout the day, so
right. This
is specific people they're calling to the room.
So what have you been doing today? What have you been up to?
I've just been doing my hobbies, which is writing and reading, and I'm hoping to play some guitar later tonight. It's a pretty open-ended day. There's really not much to do, and it's very typical. It's more or less every day is the same.
And what are you reading, Houston?
I'm reading, let's see, I've got it right here, Making the Social World, the Structure of Human Civilization by the philosopher John Searle.
So it's a book of philosophy?
Yeah.
And what kind of music?
Well, I play rock and roll guitar, so, you know, heavily distorted sort of lead guitar stuff. I aspire to play a genre called technical death metal, but it's not exactly a familiar genre to many people. And I more or less taught myself with a little bit of instruction from my father, who is a great guitar player. Yeah.
Houston, what do you say to a listener who has heard this story, heard your story, and is struggling to understand how someone could do something like what it is that you did that ended up with you in this hospital?
Right. Well, I mean, my state of mind when I committed that act was so confused. Just so out there. I mean, I was just raving mad. I mean, I thought that environmental things going on, random things, leaves falling from the trees, cats passing by, what have you, were orchestrated threats. I thought that everything was orchestrated by some foreign agency.
Were you scared?
I was horrified. It's hard to understand how somebody could do something like that. But my perception was so distorted. I don't think I even understood it was my dad there or my family there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think at one point I ended up looking at my hands and not realizing they were my own hands.
What did you think that they were?
I don't know what I thought they were, but I didn't recognize them as my own.
What did the world look like through your eyes at that point? It seems like a series of threats.
Yeah. It didn't look real. Yeah, I couldn't I couldn't tell what was, it literally looked like it was a computer simulation or a set on a movie stage or something. It was just so surreal.
Houston, do you understand why some people might be afraid of you?
Yeah.
Do you think that you're dangerous?
I don't think I'm dangerous now. No, I don't. Not only do I have better insight, I'm medicated now, of course, on the right medication.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned a lot of ways of coping with it. Not all of them really necessarily inculcated by the hospital, but sort of by a personal learning process. I couldn't imagine what would induce me to commit another action which would harm another person at this point. I feel horrible revulsion at the very thought of it.
So do you feel like you're in control of yourself now after...
Yes, I do.
When people are found guilty of a crime in the criminal justice system, they usually face a punishment, you know, a consequence.
Right.
You were found not guilty, essentially innocent,
mm-hmm.
by reason of insanity. Do you think you're being punished in a different way, nevertheless? I mean, is it fair, or do you see yourself as a type of victim because of the indefiniteness of your circumstances in this hospital?
Well, I see the class of people to which I belong as being victims. I think what people don't realize is that really the people here are more or less normal when they're not ill. And they're not ill, severely ill, that often. That's an injustice. There's always the uncertainty. There are so many people here who have been here for very long periods of time. Years and years and years and years. And it's pretty horrifying how uncertain it is. I don't see myself as being a victim necessarily, though, myself. I feel pretty guilty and pretty crummy for what I did. And some part of me believes I should be punished for it, but... Yeah.
Do you feel right now like you're a patient in this hospital or a prisoner in it?
Well, in some ways, I feel like I'm a patient. More ways, I feel like a prisoner. Yeah.
Houston, your sister was there that night in the house.
Yeah.
And she says that she meets with you. And when she meets with you, she wishes that you would apologize for what you did every time she sees you.
Right.
She wants to hear that from you.
Okay.
And she says that she doesn't, and that she thinks it would help her. Can you understand that?
Yeah. I can't understand that. I try to avoid doing that. I'm kind of scared about what'll happen if I do bring it up. If we have to go back to that time.
Is it painful?
It is a little bit, yeah. Just the other night, or a couple nights ago, I was sort of reflecting on the crime, and it's like getting the wind knocked out of you. You know? It's really hard to reconcile with how I am now. I don't know how to bring continuity to it. I mean, so I'm not really sure.
Is that why, Houston, you like philosophy now?
Perhaps. It is sort of, it's abstract enough and unemotional enough that I don't have to really deal with that stuff. And it doesn't require the continuity, really. I don't have to draw from past experiences, really, to think about abstract concepts.
Have you forgiven yourself?
No.
Do you think you ever could?
I don't know.
So, is there anything you want your your family to know that you haven't told them?
Well,
that's too hard. That's too hard to say.
Just that I'm. Oh gosh, just that I'm so sorry for what I've done and what I've done to Dad.
Houston has now been in the hospital for 4 years. Regardless of his mental state, he says that a social worker at the hospital told him that because of what he did, he can't possibly be let go for a long time. He's among at least 13,000 people involuntarily detained in state psychiatric hospitals after being found not guilty by reason of insanity or incompetent to stand trial. This song was composed and performed by Houston and Savannah's father, Mark. It's called Savannah. We'll be right back.
This podcast is supported by ACLU. The ACLU knows exactly what threats a second Donald Trump term presents, and they are ready with a battle-tested playbook. The ACLU took legal action against the first Trump administration 434 times, and they will do it again to protect immigrants' rights, defend reproductive freedom, safeguard free speech, and fight for all of our fundamental civil rights. Join the ACLU today to help stop the extreme Project 2025 agenda. Learn more at ACLU.org.
Hey, it's John Chase.
And Mari Uehara.
From Wirecutter, the product recommendation service from the New York Times. Mari, it is gift-giving time. What's an easy gift for someone like under 50 bucks?
So in our Gifts Under 50 guide, we have this super cute palm-sized Bluetooth speaker. It comes in an array of cool colors. It's waterproof. You can bring it anywhere. I want one for my garden.
I love it. Check out all of Wirecutter's gift recommendations for yourself and everyone else at nytimes.com/holidayguide.
Here's what else you need to know today. After months of rumors that its leader had been killed, the Islamic State has released what appears to be the first recording in nearly a year of its reclusive leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. The Times reports that the recording is intended to silence claims that Baghdadi died during a Russian military operation over the summer, and to rally ISIS fighters who may be demoralized after the group was driven out of one of its biggest strongholds, the Iraqi city of Mosul. And 4 months ago, Louisiana Congressman Steve Scalise, the House Majority Whip, was shot during a congressional baseball team practice in Virginia by a gunman distraught over Trump's election. The bullet traveled across Scalise's pelvis, injuring internal organs, causing severe bleeding, and leaving him in critical condition. On Thursday, Scalise walked onto the floor of Congress for the first time since the shooting.
So I'm definitely a living example that miracles really do happen.
Supporting himself with two canes and addressed his fellow House members.
Both Republican and Democrat reached out in ways that I can't express the gratitude and how much it means to me, Jennifer, and our whole family. It really does show the warm side of Congress that very few people get to see. And so I want to thank each and every one of you for that. You don't know how much it meant to me. And when I come back into this chamber here today, it just seeing the faces of all of you, it just means more to me than you can imagine. So thanks for all of that love and support.
The Daily is produced by Theo Balcom, Lindsay Garrison, Rachel Quester, Annie Brown, Andy Mills, Christopher Worth, and Ike Srizkandaraja. Lisa Tobin is our executive producer. Samantha Hennig is our editorial director. Brad Fisher is our technical manager. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. Special thanks to Larissa Anderson, Michael Simon Johnson, Peter Sale, Sam Dolman, and Michaela Bouchard. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you Monday.